and welcome back to Callum and David's Any Requests, our Patreon requested podcast where you, the listener, can donate £5 a month and get us to do a podcast on anything you want.
That's absolutely right. And this week...
I've got a message.
You've got a message
from James that I think we should read out.
To give a bit of context.
So yeah, this week comes from our patron James. And he says, as much as I'm tempted to contribute for a Hustle episode, given that the show plays a very similar role in my life to Jonathan Creek, I'm half hoping that it might eventually be worthy of an episode-by-episode breakdown podcast. For the next episode, I think I'll stick with the comedy theme. Could you do an episode on Big Train? Leaving aside the souring effects of Graham Lennon's recent outbursts, I think I do remember it being mentioned on a JCPM episode as a favourite sketch show of yours, and I think it's mostly held up really well. So
there we are.
Yeah. So I feel now that I have to promise you that I'm not James.
I mean, it is a bit weird.
I'm not James.
What we've got here, right, is a situation. Callum, have you seen the email we've got on Patreon? Oh, no, we haven't. Oh, who's it from? Oh, James? Oh, who's that? Oh, they're listening to the podcast. Oh, what have they said? And then read me that.
Yeah.
And he tried, when he read it, he tried to make it seem like it was actually written down rather than just making it up. There's absolutely no way. You and James need to meet up for a pint. I'm not, I'm still on the fence about whether you are or not. James, if you're real, you and David need to go for a pint and have a good chat. Because with that taste, I mean, I do agree, but I've never met anyone in the world, and I don't think there is anyone in the known universe that actually likes Hustle as much as David does. But you're suggesting doing an episode by episode breakdown of Hustle.
Fantastic suggestion.
Well, yeah, I mean, you would now that you're backed up by James, but even you weren't sure enough to suggest it before you did Jonathan Creek. So this guy likes Hustle just as much, if not more, than you do, and also Big Train, which, as I know, is yours and mine, one of our favourite sketch comedies.
Without a doubt.
I think
it is my favourite sketch comedy of all time.
I actually think, objectively, it's probably the best, and I'm going to talk a little bit about why I think that, because that's a big claim and no one ever mentions it when you get all the old comedians talking about what comedy was like when the old days.
Yeah.
You never hear Big Train mentioned, and I think it's ridiculous.
Falling through the bar.
That's what they talk about. And I understand exactly why Stuart Lee's annoyed by Delboy falling through the bar being the funniest thing that's ever happened in the history of the earth.
Yeah.
Because when you watch one episode of Big Train, you realise that there's more comedy in 5 minutes of Big Train than there is than so many of the things that are lauded to be wonderful and brilliant.
I mean, for me, that's why I think it's the best is just the hit rate.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's really the only kind of deciding factor when you talk about sketch shows.
Yeah.
Is what is the hit rate in terms of funny? And it just, I think, eclipses anything else I can think of.
I think that's also, I mean, when you look at shows like the Armstrong and Miller Show, the sketch show that was, very popular.
Mitchell and Webb Look as well, I'd say.
I think, actually, let's talk about that. That, for example, Mitchell and Webb had a running sketch called Hit and Miss.
Yeah.
Where Robert Webb and David Mitchell would be kind of half out of costume, being filmed talking to camera about new sketches, and they'd go, oh, do you think we've had too many hits, should we have a miss, and they'd do a sketch that wasn't quite as funny as the other. A bit of a meta commentary on the very nature of the hit and miss sketch show that you're talking about. So and even that, even being aware of it and being meta dramatic about it, still wasn't enough to push it into nearly as funny as a Big Train sketch.
And I
like Mitchell and Webb. I absolutely like Armstrong and Miller.
If you've not seen any Mitchell and Webb, go and watch the Sherlock Holmes in a nursing home sketch.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes.
It's one of my favourite sketches of all time because it is so sad. It's not funny. It's heartbreaking.
It's the best bit of acting David Mitchell's ever done in his life.
It's and Robert Webb.
And Robert,
as Watson.
Yeah.
like coming to terms with the fact that Sherlock Holmes is dying of dementia.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
I can't get the fog to clear.
It's oh my God. Watch it. It's incredible.
It's amazing. Better than Sherlock.
But there are also there's a sketch show was out maybe mid to late noughties called Cowards that no one remembers that was really good.
I missed it first time round, but you remembered it because we worked with someone who was in it.
Yes.
And so we watched a bit of it then, and I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. The sketch where it's what reminded me of Cowards was there's a big train sketch where it's like at a dinner party and it's a really obnoxious husband and he's just making fun of his wife. And then the wife just gets the carving knife and just stabs him to death at the dinner table. Yeah. And then they just all just carry on.
Yeah.
And that sketch reminded me of the Cowards Russian Roulette sketch, where it's a group of friends at dinner party playing Russian Roulette. And one of them, they realize that
there's one bullet left.
Yeah, yeah. And everyone's gone. And so he's like, well, I know I'm going to die. And they all just guilt trip against it because they're like,
oh, come on, everyone did it.
And he went, nope, fine, we won't do it then. I was really looking forward to it, but and then he does it and shoots himself
and he dies
and they're like, oh, maybe we shouldn't. And they go, no, a game's a game.
Yeah.
so good.
And I think what is similar, I suppose, in Cowards and in the description of the sketch you've just given, is a real sense of playing it straight. And it's an old Rawdon comedy that everyone talks about and very few people actually do, which is, instead of playing the joke, just play the line, and if the writing's funny, it will make sense. And I think one of the things that we'll be talking about is the ensemble cast of Big Train throughout both series, 98 and 2002, is so strong. Yeah. And when we go through, if you're not familiar with Big Train, when we go through some of the names that we're talking about, you will understand why.
I actually think that's a really fair point as well. I can't think of another sketch show with an ensemble that's this caliber, like, across the board.
Yeah.
So Big Train, written by Graham Linehan and Arthur Matthews, who, of course, made famous by Father Ted.
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal Father Ted.
And
the IT crowd.
The IT crowd, yeah.
Yeah, and Graham Linehan, now famous for being an awful, horrible transphobe.
I mean, like, a transphobe of the worst kind.
Yeah.
Like, not like an old person who's finding it all a bit difficult and might say the wrong thing. I mean, this person, he's an out-and-out turf.
Yeah.
That's difficult because with, Father Ted... Big Train, and for many people, the IT crowd, although I never really got it.
I'm Alan Partridge as well, of course. They wrote on
the I'm Alan Partridge series, you know, a bit of a comedy hero of mine, and a comedy hero of many.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, a real shame. But in this context, we'll be talking about his writing before he decided to be a huge bigot.
Yeah, so 1998 was the first series. And then 2002 was the second. So,
which was a big break.
Big break.
Big break. Yeah, which is also happening around 1998.
Yeah, yeah. John Virgo.
By another huge bigot, Jim Davidson.
Yes. Yeah. All the bigots. And I think it just took that long for them to convince the BBC to commission it because it didn't really find an audience for season one.
Right. Okay.
Again, always very kind of critically lauded and is hailed as being this amazing sitcom, but not that meant sitcom, sketch show rather. Yeah. But not that many people have actually seen it. And still to this day, not a huge amount of people know of it.
I don't know many people who know of it at all.
I remember when we were in our first year of drama school, because I own the DVD of both seasons and have done since about 2006, I think. I remember kind of introducing it to people like in halls and stuff, and no one had heard of it. And everyone was absolutely, rolling about laughing.
So good. And also... a real example of the fact that that's 10 years after the fact. And that was then. Oh, it's old now. We're old now, aren't we? So it's classic comedy in a real true sense. Not classic in the comedy as in, like, normally when someone says classic comedy, I go, do you mean a bit racist?
Yeah.
Whereas this is actually timeless in terms of its sense of humour. So a big break, didn't get a huge audience. That's shame.
No, but as we mentioned, the cast is just insane. So So for season one, you had Simon Pegg. Obviously,
who's he? Oh, one of the biggest Hollywood
superstar, Simon Pegg. Now, isn't it? The wonderful Kevin Eldon,
Who I adore. Yeah, I also think his own Kevin Eldon show.
About to say, I mean, for me, that's like a direct kind of succession, I guess, from Big Train.
Yeah,
would be the Kevin Eldon show, which is just. Maybe even more surreal.
I think it is more surreal.
Yeah.
You can see, actually, elements of Kevin Eldon in the sketches in a way that... Simon Pegg is a fantastic actor and a great day player, and Kevin Eldon is Kevin Eldon.
Yeah.
And I feel that when, you know, Eldon's sketches that revolve around characters he's created, you can really see.
Yeah,
That in there a lot, and of course some characters that have that went over to the government from Big Train.
Yeah, you also had Amelia Bullmore, who of course people probably best know her as Sonia in second series of Alan Partridge.
Yeah,
His Ukrainian
wife. I have a
wife,
bit of a
girlfriend.
Crush on Amelia Bullmore, specifically in Big Train.
Yes,
like she's so good.
She's so good. Her timing's incredible. The wonderful Julia Davis, Nighty Night, among other things.
Nighty Night was genuinely something that...
Kevin Eldon as well in Nighty Night, of course.
Yes.
Playing her husband.
Gosh, yeah.
It's me that's got the cancer.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, that's an awful scene.
Yeah.
Angus Dayton as well.
Yeah, his comeback.
With
really?
A beard.
Yeah.
Yeah, after he'd got shamed for prostitution and sacked from Have I Got News For You.
Yeah.
So I remember going, like watching Nighty Night on, was it BBC Three, early days of BBC Three?
Yeah, I think it was.
And then going into school the next day and wanting to talk to my mates about it and having the quotes of the, it's me that got the cat. Like you had, like, I mean, that doesn't happen anymore. And anyone young, I think we've got about two people under the age of 30 who are listening. that just doesn't happen anymore. Obviously because of streaming, but that was how big Nighty Night was.
Yeah.
It really pushed the envelope in terms of quite cutting edge, quite... Well, what would you... Spiky comedy.
Yeah.
It had a spikiness to it, a danger to it. Yeah, in a really smart way. Yeah, Julia Davis, amazing.
Yeah, and then, of course, my personal favourite, Mark Heap.
Mark Heap.
Who is just my comedy hero. I think I first knew him as Dr. Statham. I think I can... Because I was a little bit too young to be aware of space the first time round.
Yes, so was I.
So I think
I... I'm a bit younger than you.
I think I came to Green Wing first and just fell in love with Dr. Alan Statham as a character. I think to this day he's one of the greatest comedic characters of all time, and purely Mark Heap's delivery.
I think a lot of people, if you don't know Mark Heap from Big Train or Green Wing, you probably know him from Friday Night Dinner.
Yeah, as the neighbour. Jim?
Jim the neighbour.
Yeah.
And Jim the neighbour started off as a very kind of small character and now is... a big reason people tune into Friday Night Dinner. And I think there's a lot of Statham in Jim.
Yeah.
I prefer Statham. Maybe that's because it's first time round. I'm not a huge Friday Night Dinner fan. It's good, you know. But Mark Heap is such a creative comedian.
Yeah.
And comic performer.
Yeah. And of course, Brian in Spaced as well, down in the basement. Yeah.
Brian in Spaced, which it probably would be to, you know, the generation before us.
Yeah. And then in the second series, Julia Davis and Amelia Bullmore left, and they were replaced by Rebecca Front. Of course, again, Nighty Night and a million other things. Just brilliant.
I mean,
Rebecca Front.
For me, Rebecca Front, again, the thick of it.
The
series.
So good. So good.
She is phenomenal.
So good. Tracy Ann Oberman, who I think was EastEnders for a long time. Pops up in a lot of things. But funny enough, Tracy Ann Oberman was like best friends with my GCSE drama teacher.
Oh, really?
They went to drama school together, yeah.
I think she does quite a lot of stage stuff, actually.
Yeah.
Every now and again.
A very little known comedian. I don't think she did much after this series. Catherine Tate?
No idea. I mean, yeah. I mean, Catherine Tate, if you like the Catherine Tate show... I don't know whether you'd like her in Big Train, because like I love her in Big Train and I'm not a real fan of the Catherine Tate show.
No.
To do with personal taste and stuff like that. But still amazing. Trailblazer, following in the footsteps of people like Victoria Wood and you know, more power to her. But for me personally, I think she's better playing straight in Big Train as an ensemble member.
Well, I never have been a fan of the Catherine Tate show, and I think it's because I really don't like catchphrase comedy. And a lot of sketch shows that have recurring characters, Little Britain, all that kind of stuff. Although I thought the first series was great.
Well, but, before it became a before it became reliant on the catchphrase
comedy, and that's what Big Train never does. I mean, there's the odd episode or two that might return to a sketch within the episode, but there's no series recurring character. The only thing that recurs is in season one, the staring competition. That's the only thing that spans episodes, but there's no other sketch that appears in more than one episode.
And it's a genius idea. For those of you who are fans of sketch comedy in London, you might be aware of a show called News Review that I worked on as a musical director, but also as a writer. And News Review is great in terms of inviting young comedians, getting into the idea of a writer's room, and it launched things like the News Quiz and Have I Got News for You, and the Hudlines all started there. And amazing,
Bill Bailey.
MD on one of his jobs there. Yeah. Sarah Parrish, Oliver from, got a massive New York American TV show.
John Oliver
started on News Review. All their first gigs.
Yeah.
So when you look at that, you have kind of rules about the hour-long show, and you always say there's going to be one runner, so that we're going to have a sketch that returns three times in that 1 hour. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a musical number. You're going to have a couple of one-liners to break it up, and there's a kind of structure that goes with it.
Yeah.
And there's an element of Big Train that admires the structure, and then so says we're going to have a structure, and that is going to be breaking all those rules in a really smart way, which is if we have a runner, it's in within the episode. We're not going to rely on it. We're not going to stretch it out. We're going to write each episode as a piece of entertainment. And I think that's what actually might lead, tell me if you agree, the idea that that's why each episode is so strong. And why the hit rate is so big.
I think so.
There's not a single sketch that I don't find funny.
No.
And also, whenever you and I talk about Big Train, like, there's not one sketch that I say to, like, if someone said, oh, what's your favourite Big Train sketch?
Yeah.
I just go, oh, I don't know, there's one. But they're all, like, equally in my memory.
Yeah.
The ones that I like. And then we just watched a good hour of different sketches, a bit more than. And every single one comes flooding back.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess you can't really talk about Big Train without talking about Monty Python, because that's the catalyst of it, isn't it? That's because and the idea of, I think, surreal comedy is, as you said, it's about playing it straight. It's about absolutely realistic situations, but you just change one thing in that situation to be absurd. But everything else remains the same. And I think that's what Python's did so well. And I think that's what Big Train does. So, like, the majority of the sketches, everything is kept completely naturalistic, completely normal, except one utterly mad thing.
Yeah.
And that's where the hilarity comes from, I think.
And I think also you see that with, if you get into kind of Monty Python geekery and, different writing teams. Was that Chapman and Cleese, or was that the Terrys, or was that, Michael Palin? And how, the growth and the evolution of Python, you really start to see styles emerge. But also, having to manage those styles, they had to end up putting structures in and getting those ideas out. I think Cleese is a great example of someone who is, hilarious doing silly walks. But also sketches like the argument sketch, which is, a great favourite of mine, playing it absolutely straight.
Yeah.
The argument sketch, actually very similar perhaps in some ways to the couples counsellor, which then turns into another sketch later on. But, this absolute good acting. And, you watch, television today, and some of it's fantastic, and some of the acting is incredible, better than it was 20 years ago. And also some of it is awful.
Yeah.
But in terms of what is a BBC One drama at 9 o'clock, and it's an hour-long serial, the straight acting the believable three-dimensional characters that are coming out of Big Train are often, I would say, better drawn with much more detail than some, you know, BAFTA award-winning dramas that we have. And that's, again, I just always say this when I work with young people as well. Like, if you want to be a comedian, you have to understand how to play tragedy and serious work. And it's not just for me. It's a common thing. People have said that. It's not my idea. I've invented a way of playing comedy. But, you know, I think that's really true. And they just, all of them do that so well.
Yeah. I think for me, one of my favourite kind of recurring comedic structures that they use in Big Train is actually something you and I love about a relatively little known comedy former duo, now solo act, called The Death Hilarious.
Yes.
Who, if you don't know The Death Hilarious, please check them out. Check
if you're
out
a fan
Twitter.
Of surreal comedy,
yeah,
you need to check out The Death Hilarious.
But what they slash he does brilliantly is getting you along a certain way of a sketch, and you assume it's going to go somewhere, and then that's not the joke of the sketch. The joke of the sketch suddenly comes about 5 seconds before the end of the sketch that is completely unrelated to the journey he's taken you on and just veers off at the very end. And I think, like, for example, you just mentioned the couples counselor sketch, which is a recurring thing of basically a very perverted guy kind of getting his way into these jobs, and then at the very end, two English bobbies turn up and chase him off.
Yeah.
And the joke isn't actually about the fact that the guy's a pervert or he's, you know, getting off on asking this couple about their sexual experiences.
Yeah.
The joke is actually how long the sound of the steps go on for, the footsteps go on for.
Yeah.
That's the gag of that, and that comes at the very end.
Yeah.
But that's the main gag of those recurring sketches, because it does it, and then he's a magician and trying to get a woman to put his hand in his pocket. But then again, you get it again, and you just have for far too long the sound of someone running downstairs, and that's the gag of that sketch. And that's what I mean. They do it so many times. You go, oh yeah, I get what this joke's going to be, and then they just totally go in the other direction.
And I think part of why I like surreal comedy, and perhaps why a lot of industry people love surreal comedy, The Death Hilarious deserve, you know, to be much higher recognized, much more recognized than they are. But talk to a lot of industry people, Big Train, again, it's a, like, comedian's comedian kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Is, I think, because as an audience, you are brought into the world. So watching Big Train and going along with wherever they take you and then being wrong-footed involves creativity as an audience.
Yeah.
Whereas if you want to laugh at season 3 of Little Britain, all you have to do is wait for the disabled man to come on and make a funny noise and everyone goes, oh, I know that's the funny bit. And they laugh.
Yeah.
But they don't have to do any work.
Yeah.
Whereas to be wrong-footed in a Big Train sketch or a Death Hilarious sketch, you have to go along the journey first.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a creative process watching comedy like this. And I don't think there are many sketch shows you can say that with.
No, and it's quite amazing that even now, watching those sketches back, the canned laughter doesn't bug me, and I don't really know why it doesn't, because most things it does now, but for that, I maybe it's because I'm always laughing at the same time as the canned laughter.
I think
canned laughter,
really,
you don't
well,
kind of notice.
I think it's well done canned laughter.
Yeah.
But it is 90s canned laughter. Like, you can hear, or 2002 canned laughter, still pretty 90s to me. Like, you can hear the sound of the people laughing. It's just very... is very dated, but it's really really well timed. But I don't think I'd miss it. I don't think I'd miss it.
No, I wouldn't miss it, but it doesn't bother me. But so we should probably just get into a few of our favourite sketches.
I think
really, that's
probably the way to go. I mean, one sketch I talk about a lot was actually the first one that we had a look at, and it's the first runner. Which means there are three small sketches, and it's about a boss in a very kind of mid-scale office, and three disgruntled employees played with real subtlety and detail walk into the office, and Mark Heaps, the boss, and they say, look, you know, we're still waiting on this check for the overtime that we did last month, and we're all getting a bit brassed off with the fact that we're not getting paid. And he goes, oh, no, I'm really sorry. I'll get it for you in one moment. He just says, but just before you do, just pick a card, any card. And he's just fanning out these cards like a magician, picks a card, does a card trick.
Yeah.
They all go, wow, it's amazing. Did you have the card in your pocket? And whilst they're being distracted by how good the card trick was, the boss gets out the door into a taxi, gets on a plane and skips the country. Now, I don't know why that sketch is so funny.
Yeah.
Apart from the fact that everyone... One, the detailed nuance of the reality of it.
Yeah.
Of the way they're playing it. Plus the fact that they would all get distracted by a card trick. But also, I think what makes it funny is the fact that Mark keeps a really dexterous magician.
Yeah.
And so by the time we've had the next sketch, which is the same premise, they're really annoyed now. We're not going to be fobbed off by any tricks.
Yeah.
He goes, oh, just have a look in this drawer. Oh, three oranges.
Yeah.
And then does some incredibly skillful juggling.
Yeah.
So I'm laughing at the boss, but I'm also really enjoying how good Mark Heap is at juggling.
Yeah.
And then by the third time, they say, right, that's it. We're not leaving until we get our checks. And he says, I know. Look in that drawer. I open the drawer. And there are puppies. Newborn puppies in the drawer, which completely distracts them. And he skips the country again.
I should say Kevin Eldon's brilliant in the top of that third one as well. When he just comes in and just tips everything over. It's just the way it's hilarious.
Because he's playing, I'm really angry, but I'm still nervous for my job.
Yeah.
And I'm not very good at showing it.
Yeah.
So I know I want to tip over this file of facts, but I'm not quite sure how to do it because actually I'm a rule follower.
Yeah.
And those are the people that get screwed over. But that detail is not going to be stage directed in a script.
That's
an actor going, who is this guy? And I don't know any actor who actually thinks about their characters anymore before they go on television. You get it in the theatre, of course you do. And you get it in method acting films, but you don't get many people giving believable three-dimensional performances in a 45-minute sketch.
No.
So I love that sketch, and also there are many situations true to life that remind me of it.
Yeah.
Mainly trying to chase invoices from producers who are often trying to juggle money and are often on planes or in different parts of the world. You're going, how long can we leave it before we get angry? Do we want to get angry because we want to get employed again? But also it's been 4 months. Like there are so many situations where you go, oh, this is just like the Mark Heap sketch.
Yeah.
And I think it's a lovely example of Mark Heap doing straight comedy.
Yeah.
Whereas Green Wing and Friday Night Dinner and some of the other characters that he's known for are all quite outlandish character comedy.
Yeah, very true.
What about you?
I think to this day, I'm kind of like you. It's hard to pick a favourite. But if I had to pick a favourite sketch, the one that sticks in my mind most, and I don't know why, is the sketch where... I can't remember if it's Simon Pegg or Kevin Eldon. I think it's Kevin Eldon, is being followed by Mark Heap, dressed fully as the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And accompanied by really scary, like, Hitchcock-esque, like, psycho music. and that one's a runner in the episode, and it just keeps going. And he's getting more and more nervous about being followed by the Tin Man, Tin Man. And then the sketch ends with him turning up a dinner party at his friend's, and he comes in and he just sees that the Tin Man sat there.
Yeah.
And he just gets up and goes, oh, I think I saw you earlier, but I don't think you saw me. That's really normally. And he just kept on and just looks terrified. I don't know why it makes me laugh so much. I don't know why I find it so funny, but that's the one that always sticks in my head most.
I don't know. For me, I think if I was trying to analyse the comedy, what's the point? But I think there's something along the lines of, you think he's scared because it's a Tin Man with scary music.
Yeah.
But actually, it's just because he keeps seeing this guy everywhere. And doesn't know that he's going to this party.
Yeah.
So actually, the fact that he's dressed as a Tin Man with silver paint over his face is absolutely fine.
Irrelevant. Yeah.
Again, I think it's the idea of going, you think you know where the sketch is going.
Yeah.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
The person with the problem that's weird is Kevin Eldon, not the Tin Man.
Yeah.
There's one sketch I'm going to talk about later because it's a bit of a wild card.
Yeah.
For me, and that's the traffic light. Sketch. One of my favourites also is. And again, I think the ones that stick in my mind are the weird ones.
Yeah.
There's just a really realistic scene of a bunch of firemen putting out a fire in a house. And it's really, really realistically played by all the firemen and by the people in the house. So it's quite serious. It's very kind of... It's not London's Burning. It's not made to look like a drama. It's just real. And the firemen, their jobs, being interfered with by these young children who want to be firemen.
Yeah.
But instead of them actually being young children, they're all adults dressed as jockeys. But they're all acting like they're like 6-year-old, 7-year-old children.
Yeah.
So somewhere in this universe, there is like 6 or 7 jockeys who all desperately want to be firemen and keep turning up to fires, pretending to be firemen. And one of them actually like firemen's lifts one down. But instead of being serious and focusing on the job, they're getting too excited by it.
Yeah.
And the fireman turns up and he's played by wonderful Simon Greenall.
Yeah.
Who, again, you would know from Iron Man and Partridge or Alpha Papa.
Michael!
Michael, monkeys, you hoid a monkey in the sea. Eat on me fags.
A cup of beans.
he just really, really realistically, he's like, okay, all right. Eventually he lets one of them help and then they all have a little go and then they mess around with a fire hose and he sends them off again. But you have to buy that not only do jockeys want to be firemen, you also have to buy the fact that all these adult jockeys who want to be firemen behave very realistically like 6 or 7-year-old children.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't know why all of those things are together.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're all in, like, the costume's brilliant. The shooting of it's very, very detailed.
Yeah.
It's really laboured, so it's not like it's a quick gag. It's long. And the BBC paid for this.
Yeah.
And paid people to do, they put money into it. I think that's the thing that also makes me laugh, is that someone's actually, it's like when we read Onion articles, you know, it's a satirical American magazine, or you might have seen Clickhole, which is kind of its little cousin, you know, like 4 or 5 A4 page articles about complete fictional nonsense. And I go, so someone got paid to write that. Like, that makes me laugh even more than the original side of the comedy, I think.
And again,
Amelia Bullmore's phenomenal in it.
Brilliant.
Just hilarious.
Turning off the water pressure.
Just the pressure.
Yeah.
It's like, that's a really realistic thing that if you're 6, if you're an adult jockey. And they're not just jockeys, like, they're not jockeys, actually. They're dressage.
They are, they're not jockeys.
There's a difference. Yeah, they're in, like, livery and dressage.
Because there's a different sketch with jockeys. There's a sketch.
The Prince sketch?
Yeah,
I've forgotten, that's one of my favourites.
There's a sketch on the Serengeti with jockeys that are being, what's the word?
Stalked,
yeah. By the predator of the Serengeti, who is the artist formerly known as Prince.
It's just a really good Prince lookalike.
Yeah. So imagine a nature documentary, but the gazelles have been replaced by, like, as in, like, Frankie Dettori style jockeys, and the lion has been replaced by Prince, and that's the sketch.
But I don't know how they shot it without, like, it's so well shot.
They can't have flown them out to Africa. But
no.
It looks like a desert.
But there's something about also Big Train, is if it was a Little Britain sketch or a Catherine Tate sketch or something, you know, then they would have had a green screen and it would have looked really naff.
Yeah.
Or they would have, you know, tried to make a really realistic set and it would have looked really naff. Big Train seemed to have this ability to go, oh, what budget do we have? Oh, right, let's make it look good within those parameters.
And as a result, you
end up with that looking like real documentary footage and a kind of Attenborough detailed, you know, and now here they are being corralled across the savannah there by, and if you look carefully, you can just see crouching in the grass the artist formerly known as Prince creeping up on them, and then he catches one, and it's just fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And again, these now huge comic actors who in some ways owe their careers to this sketch.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, yeah, you got to remember that, like, this, like, none of them were the level they are now.
Absolutely not. And they're all just playing with as much commitment when they're the centre of a sketch. Simon Pegg playing as much commitment as he does Scotty. One of his big Hollywood films. As he is playing one jockey being hunted by the artist formerly known as Prince. Like, that's the level of commitment is exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that's what I think makes it so good. Yeah, that's a brilliant one. I think actually we watched the entirety of the staring contest sketches bunched together. And I haven't watched them all together for a long time.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever actually seen all of the segments.
No, I don't think I've ever seen them together yet.
And like it's probably the most amount of footage because it crosses the episodes, like you say.
Yeah.
It's the only sketch
20 minutes. It's
a 20-minute short film. Go watch that short film.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's brilliant, but also by the end of it, you will think you know quite a lot about the staring championships.
So,
like, it tricks you.
So I have to be honest. This has always been the one thing about Big Train I didn't really get.
The staring championships.
I never really found the staring championships that funny. I always got a bit bored.
Mm-hmm.
Watching it as a full 20-minute piece, I found it hysterical. I loved it. And I was like, I finally get it now. Seeing it all together like that.
That's really interesting.
I thought it was brilliant. And you've got Barry Davies as one of the voices. Like, an actual football commentator as one of the voices. And you've got the great Phil Cornwall.
I can't believe Barry Davis is so good. I mean, I was reading his Wikipedia because I don't really know the name of commentators, and to be honest, listeners at home, neither do you. but you go. This guy was the voice of the Oxford Varsity boat race, all the Olympics, huge athletics commentator.
Oh, yeah,
and you know his voice.
Yeah.
I know his voice. I don't watch sport. He's phenomenally good. Like, the acting is incredible. Because he's acting all the way through that.
Yeah.
I think at points he's better than Phil Cornwell. And Phil Cornwell's a wonderful actor, voice artist, and impressionist.
Yeah.
You know him from all the John Coleshaw.
Dead Ringers and all
Dead
that.
Dead Ringers. Coleshaw and Stevenson, the Impression Show, all
Stella
of that
Stella Street.
Stella
Street.
Stella
Street.
Greg Dyke. His Greg Dyke character featured on that.
Yeah.
Which is Greg Dyke as Michael Caine.
Yeah.
Which I always quite like.
Yeah.
Hello. My name's Greg Dyke. Not a lot of people know that. Great actor. But I actually think out acted by Barry Davies, who at that point's, you know, fairly elderly sports commentator.
Yeah.
But I think, again, it's the detail, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the detail in the commentary. Is what the
sketch
isn't.
When you watch it as a full thing, by the end of those 20 minutes, as you say, you completely understand the world and, like, the lore of this fictional staring competition championships.
Yeah.
And it's all illustrated, which is really cool as well. But I believe it was based on a graphic novel, I think,
something
like that. Yeah. It was based on an external thing by a different writer. Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. They world build so well.
Yeah.
And normally in sketches, you have to world build very quickly because it's only going to last a few minutes.
Yeah.
But Big Train always make the sketch go on longer than it should because part of the comedy, like, as you say, it's not the sketch, actually. It's the amount of footsteps the English bobbies take to catch the criminal.
Yeah.
Like, every sketch goes on for a little bit longer than you should. And I think you and I are big fans of comedy that goes on for a little bit longer than it should. Yeah. Death Hilarious is a prime example.
Yeah.
Stuart Lee is also a huge example.
Oh, God, yeah.
Because
the master of it.
The comedy is in the relationship between the audience and the artist.
Yeah.
And that's something that that Graham Linehan is...
Well, there's that...
And Arthur Dayton Matthews and all those greats understand.
There's that great... video on YouTube that someone's done where they've looped a Stuart Lee bit, and it's so hard to know when the loop starts again.
Yeah.
It's so good
because of the use of repetition and the rhythm and
Kevin Eldon, of course, a big Stuart Lee guy as well, used a lot in Stuart Lee the comedy vehicle. Yeah,
Him and Paul Putner.
Yeah,
and Paul Putner of
Paul Putner is in Big Train.
Big Train and also the Kevin Eldon show.
Yes.
So a lot of kind of crossover there of using. I think he's a great straight guy, isn't he?
Yeah.
Butner.
Yeah. Another one of mine that I love, actually, because it has that structure in terms of the gag only ever comes at the last second of the sketch. And I believe it's from the second season, because I believe it's Simon Pegg and Tracy Ann Oberman. And they're playing
they're British,
but they're big Hollywood writer. And she's a Hollywood actress, and they're having an affair. And the whole sketch is this played very straight about this affair. And he's like very braggadocious and like talking about, you know, this great new thing that's been greenlit, and he's going to do that. And they're laughing about the fact they're cheating on their spouses and oh, well, and it's all this very, very Hollywood, very big shot thing.
It feels like Days of Our Lives kind of sense of drama.
Yeah. And then at the very, very end of the sketch, the joke is that Simon Pegg has no upper body strength and he can't open some sliding doors. And that's it. But again, just hilarious, because he's so cocksure and he's so, and it's all planned, and you just don't know where the, you're waiting for the joke and you're like, I don't get it.
This is just believable drama.
And then at the very end, and it's literally just some like sliding glass patio doors and he can't open them for ages. And again, it goes on for ages and ages, him trying to open these doors.
But I don't even think about that sketch very often, but whenever I see Simon Pegg open a door in anything, I think of that sketch. I'm like, oh, he's not going to be able to open the door. Oh, no, it's Star Trek. It's not this. It's some other massive Hollywood film. And he's such a good physical comedian, Simon Pegg. People think he's kind of like a witty, throwaway British guy and Edgar Wright and all that kind of stuff. And he is all of those things. And that is what the Americans see him as. But actually, if he was, you know, making comedy in the 60s, he would be the physical comedian, because he's got a great physical comedy. I mean, that weird Ritz sketch where it's about a guy buying the Ritz Hotel. They say, yeah, great, fantastic, thanks very much. And then he says, oh, one stipulation. He says, what's that? He says, I want to change it, the name of the hotel, from the Ritz to the Tits. And they have a conversation for about 4 minutes about the fact that this is not a good idea.
Yeah.
And he goes, no, you're not saying it right. It's not tits.
It's with a Z.
It's tits.
It's with a Z.
Yeah.
So it's fine.
And then they basically go, oh, we're not going to get through this.
Yeah.
And Simon Pegg's character goes, oh, do you want to see my impression of a monkey? And does a ferociously realistic impression of a monkey. And you go, oh, you did animal studies at college, didn't you?
Yeah.
But again, not where you thought the sketch was. You thought the sketch was about them being surprised. You thought it was a classic joke about, you know, wouldn't it be funny if? And it's not. It's not wouldn't it be funny if. It's Simon Pegg doing
being a chimpanzee,
impression.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. That wrong foots you all the time. I think also some sort of sketch that goes on for a long time is this police sketch artist.
Yeah.
Which.
Yeah.
So a woman's been attacked or a crime has been committed. She's clearly shaken up by it. And Amelia Bullmore is again playing very, very good acting, with Kevin Eldon playing a police sketch artist. Unfortunately, every time he asks her for a description, she says, her answers are they're all abstract descriptions. So he said, what was his eyes like? And she says, oh, they were melancholic.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, like a bit like this. She's like, no, like more despairing than that. It's like, oh, okay, so they're sad. Like, yeah, more like a bat's eyes.
Yeah.
And he's like, what, were they hooded? She's like, no, not hooded. Silly. And over the course of this, Kevin Eldon's professionalism as a policeman drops.
Yeah.
And his frustration as an artist comes out.
Yeah.
So you think the sketch is about her describing a criminal badly or in a kind of abstract, artistic, impressionistic way. But no, the sketch is the policeman is a frustrated artist.
Yeah.
Not a policeman and then, who can draw.
And then by the end of the sketch, he's being comforted by her. And she goes, look, come on, we'll try it again. He's in tears because he's so frustrated by her. But
brilliant.
And his ears look like two dead fat Japanese businessmen.
No, you got the Japanese bit, but the fat dead bit, but you haven't got the dead yet.
Oh, is it the pinstripe suit? Yeah. Were they in pinstripe suits? Well, it is. So good.
And she sees through his sarcasm. Yeah. It becomes very real and human.
So his eyebrows were as if they were on retractable springs, but not actually on retractable springs. Yeah.
What, here? No, they were above his eyes. Oh, they were above his eyes, were they? Were they? Oh, great. But, like, again, this frustration not of a policeman. It's a frustration of an artist. He's like, I went to college for this. Why am I doing this?
His nose good? Just more mainstream.
Yeah, just... Brilliant. It's a really brilliant, 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 brilliant sketch.
Yeah, love that one.
I also think when you talk about Big Train as a show and the careers of all the amazing people who have been in it, I was interested to see that Chris Morris directed the pilot.
Yes, but it didn't air, I believe.
It didn't air, and Graham Linehan directed most of the episodes, I believe. But the fact that Chris Morris worked with both Graham Linehan and Arthur Matthews and Stuart Lee and Amanda Iannucci and Steve Coogan, you know, the crossover of people on the day-to-day Brass Eye and Jam.
I was going to say, you can't talk about Big Train without talking about Jam. It's like half the cast of Big Train.
Yeah.
But it's like Big Train's darker, twisted cousin.
It's so weird.
Mr. Lizard. You're Mr. Lizard. No one will understand that if you've never seen Jam, but do if you're out here and you love Big Train but you've never seen Jam, you go and watch Jam, because it's exact same style of humor. It's most of the same people.
But arrange after you watch Jam, make sure that you like keep yourself safe. Arrange to go and see someone that you trust and have a little drink with, or that your flatmate's in and have a cup of tea or something like that. Don't watch it and then go to bed.
Yeah, because Chris Morris has gone, oh, do you know what 90s British sketch comedy's missing? Like avant-garde ambient music underneath all the sketches.
Yeah, it's
like,
really unsettling.
So weird. Yeah.
I mean, I think Chris Morris is underscored by his own avant-garde ambient music wherever he goes.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful interview with him last year, I think, a year or so, pardon me, ago, in The Guardian. And the journalist, just really well written, I can't remember who wrote it, just describes Chris Morris really, really beautifully and wonderfully. And he doesn't even have a smartphone, because he's like, oh, they're not getting my data.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he says he has this wonderful, wonderful way of just telling you you're wrong without making you feel like you're wrong, but telling you in six different ways where he's more intelligent.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think at one point the journalist said, oh, well, you know, when you think about the country's going through a seismic change, and he went, well, unless you're talking about the weather, then no, because that's, that's a scientific word. That means that's to do with earthquakes. Like, you know, just having this brilliance. And I think it's amazing. Anyone who seems to have touched Chris Morris at some point in their career, I seem to enjoy.
Yeah.
And there's more evidence of that than there is Chris Morris's career in some ways.
Yeah.
But he directs episodes of Veep and things.
Oh, God. Yeah, 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 yeah. Amazing. Well, I mean, great. him and Amanda Iannucci, who is another name that is frequently
synonymous
with
British
these
comedy.
People. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, I would have to say, for me, the Amanda Iannucci show might be up there with Big Train in terms of my favourites. I mean, well, both the Amanda Iannucci shows,
Time Trumpet,
are just so good, so good. I mean, my favourite sketch of all time is from the Amanda Iannucci shows. I mean, it's so much so my favourite that people actually make fun of me for the amount of times I talk about it.
Is this the Made of Paper one?
Yeah.
So for as long as I've known David,
yeah,
I have known how important this one sketch is to him.
Yeah.
You describe the sketch, and then I'll describe something that happened recently.
So, the sketch is, and again, this isn't from Big Train, this is from the Amanda Iannucci shows. I believe it's the first sketch of the first episode, or very, very early on. It's an estate agent and a young couple being shown around a house, and the estate agent's doing his kind of spiel. And the girlfriend's really loving it, loving the house, really positive about it. And the boyfriend, it slowly realizes that everything in the house is made out of paper. And he's like turning on the tap and it's just melting. And he's like just putting his hand through things. It's all paper. It's paper. Everything's made out of paper. And then the sketch ends. They walk out of the house and it's a child's drawing of a house. And it just pans over and there's a bunch of five-year-olds with a giant pencil who just run away. But also the girlfriend's like, oh, you shouldn't, can't be so picky. Like, can't be so rude. He's right. So like, she's on this stage at the side and it's like, he's the mad one. But we can all see that everything in the house is literally made out of paper.
Yeah, it's exactly, yeah. Imagine where, you know, I'm sure you've all experienced an estate agent showing you around a house and you go, oh, this is rubbish. It's not what you told me it would be. We've had to arrange different, it's been difficult to coordinate this. Now I'm really annoyed by it.
Yeah.
It's just very, very naturalistic representation of that. Except instead of it being the type of thing that would annoy you in real life, like, oh, it's not as big as he said it was, or the, oh, actually it needs a lot of work. The entire house, as you say, is made of paper, and it takes it into that surreal place. And I think that's very, very much akin to Big Train and a Chris Morris-esque way of looking at things. Although they all have their different quirks and different styles.
Salt paper.
Pushing it into that surreal... I mean, you and I have looked around flats. We live together, as we've informed you all before, in a little flat. And, you know, walking into a house together with an estate agent is not great.
No.
Because both of us are just... both paper. Just thinking about that and hearing the words, it's all paper, in our heads the whole time.
Yeah.
But also, you got the pleasure of meeting the great Armando Iannucci.
Yes.
I was really jealous of this, but you worked together.
Yes. So,
only once, not for long.
Yeah. I was involved very kind of tangentially in a producer capacity for a segment on Children in Need, BBC's Children in Need last year. And the segment was related to a bunch of kids taking over the filming, the production of Armando Iannucci's David Copperfield. So I was on set for that and got the chance to have a little chat with Armando, who was just lovely and humble and just hilarious, just wonderfully brilliant.
He was working with the kids.
Yeah,
and he was
explaining
a little bit about how he worked.
He was basically like, because these kids were not professional actors at all, so he was kind of explaining, like, they'd obviously all worked really hard learning their lines and things like that, and he just went, look, I will say everything that's on the script, I will say the first line and I will say the last line correctly, don't worry about what I do in between those two things. And he did it, and he made the script 100 times better. He was just riffing and it was great. But yes, I told him that my favorite sketch of all time was that sketch, and he was touched and also very confused that I remembered this show that he'd done way before any of the big stuff he'd done, and that was this I'm happy that I must be the only person in the world that's what I've said to Armando Iannucci. I love Veep. No, I love the paper sketch from the Armando Iannucci shows.
Going, really?
But yeah, Time Trumpet as well is genius, which is a show that is essentially like an I Heart the 90s show, but set in the future about
you've got like two like geriatric pensioners talking about Take That.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I remember when Robbie left.
Yeah, it's like, it's about the time it was made, which was like early noughties, but it's set in the future and you've got all these old like actors playing various people, like Tim Henman and Tony Blair and things like that. And yeah, it's just very, very funny. Another, going back to Big Train.
Yes.
Another sketch we should talk about is the sketch miles ahead of any other that you and I reference. You and I have referenced this sketch probably about once a week in the 12 years that we've known each other.
Oh, gosh.
It is so common, just that comes up constantly.
Is this the George Martin one?
No.
No?
No.
Because I feel like I referenced that a lot.
No. No.
No, what is it?
Well, actually, if I say the phrase, is that a reference?
Oh my goodness. Okay, yeah. No, that's ridiculous. Literally about once a week we say this.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, that is one of the best sketches to raise talking about this sketch show.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's in the show, but also because it's like, I feel like it epitomizes quite a lot of the show.
Yeah. So it's just in a pub, and Mark keeps having a drink with some friends, and everything's just kind of having a general chat. And then someone makes a comment, and Mark Heap's face just suddenly drops. And he just says, I'm sorry, is that a reference to me not being married? And again, this is a runner. So you keep coming, and he gets angry, and then the last time you see this character questioning it, he is clearly insane because he goes, is that reference to me not being married? What don't you talk about? He goes, I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bell's gonna chop. And then he chops the end of his finger off
with a cigar cutter.
With a cigar cutter. And then
the friend
his
comes
friend
back.
Comes back and he eats the end of his finger. It's so surreal. But any time someone says, oh, is that a reference? You and I always go to me not being married.
Yeah.
All the time. Like we talk about that sketch so much.
Yeah. It's because I think you think that he's oversensitive.
Yeah.
Right. So you're expecting that to be because of the way we're so used to comedy being. You're expecting that to be the gag. But actually it's that he's so beyond psycho, it's like it's nothing to do with really what was going on around him. Eating his own finger. Absolutely. There's also a couple of sketches that I think kind of like take a dig that almost could be seen as commentary,
right?
And this is a real stretch here.
Okay,
because I don't think for a second that that any of the writing is based in kind of like political satire.
Yeah.
But there's a little dig at local radio. and I kind of get it. But Simon Pegg's just doing a really, like a boringly accurate impression of a radio DJ. Again, they never go for, oh, a funny version of a radio DJ. They go, no, just an actual radio DJ.
Yeah.
So elements of that are funny in the sense that it's recognisably accurate.
Yeah.
But that's it. And he's making lots of punny jokes and he can't think of anything to say. He's thinking for a pun about Batman. And then he says, listen to some music and I'll be back in a moment. And then he walks down out of the studio into the back office where he shouts, where are my Batman puns? I haven't got enough puns. He's got a baseball bat.
Yeah.
That he rattles along the side of the radiator to make a note, like it's all Bond villain stuff. And then the camera turns around and it's all genuine 7 or 8 year old children. Who are kind of, they look like, you know, the urchins from Les Miserables. And they're all like covered in, you know, soot and you know, starving. And they're chained to desks with pen and paper. And he says, you know, I want 50 puns. You got 2 minutes. I want 50 puns, right? And it's not, and if not, you're not getting any bloody food.
Yeah.
So, and then, so you think, okay, well, the sketches that
children
radio
writing,
DJs get their puns supplied by child pun writing sweatshops.
Yeah.
And you go, okay, it's that. And then the camera starts to pan out.
Yeah.
Of this very realistic scene, and a filter goes over, and it all looks a little bit almost dreamlike. And then a voiceover comes in with Mark Heap explaining, and then you learn that actually this is an advert for a charity whose mission is to free children who have been put into sweatshops for writing puns for radio DJs.
Yeah.
And there are pictures of like Little Timmy, freed from Radio Gloucester.
Yeah.
You know, Sarah, freed, 8 years old, freed from Chiltern FM.
Yeah.
It's like, if you could help free one of these children who are currently...
for just £3 a month.
Just £3 a month.
It becomes a charity advert. No one ever saw coming.
So absolutely, completely off piece. But that's the thing that makes it go from a sketch, you know, like you see now, where you go, that's good.
Yeah.
To oh my goodness, I'm in stitches, and that's what Big Train does every single time.
Yeah,
I just adore it. There's one other that I think is a commentary, and it's quite clever. And that's Chaka Khan versus the Bee Gees. So you've got, right, so you've got Chaka Khan.
Yeah.
And the Bee Gees are having a shootout in 1800s Wild West America.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
And that's basically it.
Yeah, I mean, no, that is. That's the gag.
That's the gag. And the Bee Gees are trying to, you know, shoot Chaka, and one by one the Bee Gees fall.
Yeah.
Robin Gibb, played by Kevin Eldon, gets shot far too many times, and it goes on for too long, which makes us laugh.
Yeah.
And then it's down to Barry Gibb and Chaka, and Simon Pegg playing Barry Gibb. I'm coming for you, Chaka. And then get shot. And then there's an alternative history about what... And it's all set, not in the 70s.
Yeah.
In the 1850s.
Yeah.
And there's an alternative history about what happened to disco after the great shootout of the 1856.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand. Like, is it a documentary? Is it a drama doc about... an alternative universe
and where... Chaka Khan gets this old photograph out of her and the three Bee Gees all as toddlers playing together and like crying over the body.
Yeah, and then at the end it says Chaka Khan eventually handed in her badge to the sheriff's office. I was like, oh, she was a sheriff? Like, there's so much detail. Like, four screens of... But it was interesting because there was a huge shootout in the form of disco... in the 70s, and well, 80s, really, with Chaka. And she is one of the highest-selling R&B and disco artists. And I realise she's got 10 Grammys.
Yeah.
And she's estimated to sell over 70 million copies.
Yeah.
Which is massive. And I thought, oh, well, that's got to be bigger than the Bee Gees. And Bee Gees are British, and Chaka's American. Yeah. She probably did win the shootout. Not true.
No.
The Bee Gees... definitely sold 120 million copies, but there's records, copies of what? Just records in general. Yeah. But there's an estimated 220 million records that they think have been sold.
Wow.
That are unaccounted for. And were crowned the kings of disco. So actually, I think this is an alternative history of what would happen if Chaka Khan won the disco battle and also happened to exist in the Wild West of America in the 1800s.
Right. Yep.
So it's clever on two levels.
Yeah.
Not just silly, surreal comedy. It's some cultural commentary in there as well, you know? It's smart stuff. They weren't messing around.
I mean, speaking of music-based sketches, we have to talk about George Martin because it's just genius.
It's my favourite Kevin Eldon character of all time.
Yeah, and who does turn up again in the Kevin Eldon show.
Much to my... I was ecstatic when that happened. It's the best thing that ever happened to me was that sketch coming back.
I think this might be... the only example in Big Train of actual observational comedy, because it is true. Because George Martin ever did, rest in peace, was go on things and talk about the Beatles, on anything.
Yeah.
So it's just that taken to the extreme. But I think it's the only thing that's actually the gag is rooted in a realistic observation of what George Martin does.
But yeah,
it's just George Martin taken hostage in the Middle East, won't stop talking about the Beatles. And it's like him chained up, and the other hostage is going mad listening to him. And then he's like underneath the truck. Like,
so not talking to anyone?
No, and they just wheel him out front of this truck and he's mid-conversation. They rescue him. He's talking about the Beatles to the rescuers. They go to the press conference of the rescued hostages and asking actual questions about the hostages. And he can only respond by talking about, like, well, you know, everyone had a problem with Ringo's drumming, but I thought he was great.
Do you think your capture was more political or do you think it was personal? Yeah. And then he just comes back again with, I mean, if you listen to Strawberry Fields, you know, to name a few. But the thing is that I, being a bit of, you know, both of us are quite, you know, professional appreciators of music, and we've done podcasts about our top five favourite tracks and intros and outros and all sorts. Like, I've listened to quite a lot of George Martin, like, anecdotes, and I've watched documentaries, and I've read books, and I've listened to all of In My Life, and read all the programmes. Like, I think everything Kevin Eldon's saying is stuff George Martin has actually said.
It does sound like
because
it,
because it's so accurate.
Yeah.
I know Kevin Eldon's a huge music buff as well, and plays a lot of instruments. Yeah. And, but so it might well be absolutely true, but it does, it's the only thing that's surreal about it is the length to which they take the idea.
Yeah.
And of course, at the end of the sketch, the rescuer who's sitting next to him in the press conference actually tries to strangle him.
Throttles him, yeah.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful idea. What did George Martin do on the earth? Talk about the Beatles.
Beatles, yeah, yeah.
That was it. One other sketch that I said I was going to mention was the traffic light sketch.
Yes.
And it's because, unlike trying to make sense of or going on a journey or any of the kind of attempts at understanding this surreal comedy show that I've made so far, stops at this sketch because I don't know what it is. I just know that it makes me happy.
Yeah.
But how do you explain it?
It's a parody of a French art house short film.
Yeah. And it's subtitled, and the filtration is that.
Much in the same vein as the one Barney Gumble makes in The Simpsons.
Yes.
It's that style of French film that they're parodying.
But the thing is, in The Simpsons, it's parodied.
Yeah.
And it's obviously lovingly parodied.
Yeah.
In this, it's just accurately recreated. Again, they forget to make the filming of it funny, or
the lighting
over the top, or the performances larger than life.
Yeah.
It's just really boringly accurate French cinema.
Yeah.
And not like clearly 70s French cinema with, you know, cigarette burns on the film. It's as if it was made now.
Yeah.
And it's just a series of, you know, it's a love affair French film where a couple are working out whether they're basically compatible, real for each other, or whether they can stay together. And it's all in French with English subtitles.
Yeah.
Which means all the actors that we've been talking about for this episode speak fluent French.
There's several French sketches.
I think a few of them must speak French.
That must be a thing, yeah.
I remember the one where the canal runners.
Oh god, yeah. Do you speak English? No, sorry, mate. No, not what. Nah. Sorry, mate. And then the same thing happens in French. And he replies the same in French.
And in sprechen Sie Deutsch? Nein. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it doesn't matter what language you're speaking in.
Yeah.
No one can ever speak your language, but they'll always tell you in the accent of your own language.
Yeah.
But again, the work and the time and effort, you know, it would have taken to do this, presumably.
Yeah.
Is far too much. Now, what I haven't mentioned is that one of the people in the relationship in this French film that we're following is a set of temporary traffic lights. Now, I don't know what you do with that.
Like, yeah.
It's just really straightly played. And it's a pair of, you know, the set of traffic lights you get at roadworks.
Yeah.
It's that.
Yeah.
Is it yellow, big enough, and in a restaurant, on a walk in the park, and there's this love affair, and we follow it.
Yeah.
And everyone's speaking French, and it's subtitled and shot really beautifully, and I don't understand why or how.
Beautifully underscored.
But that's it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't go anywhere. There's not like a twist there.
Right.
It's just, we see this through, we enjoy it, and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
Really, really good. I think also in the way of how it's shot, it might be worth mentioning the cat and the mouse sketch. Because this is something that you and I think of quite a lot.
Yeah.
So I'll start off in the pub, having very realistic conversation. They're so good at realistic conversations in pubs.
Yeah.
Like, just that, hi mate, how you doing? Yeah, all right. And they're like, oh, so have you told her? Oh, what? No, it just rained. Midway conversation, you go, yeah, absolutely believable.
Yeah.
And then you just want to go to Soap Writers and go, do that for real. It's really much more convincing. Really naturalistic. Except one of them around the table is a giant mouse.
Yeah.
And is a Calvin Elton in a mouse costume.
Yeah.
But with makeup on his face. Like, I think it's that he is actually a mouse.
He's actually a mouse, yeah.
It's not a man pretending to be a mouse.
No.
He's a mouse. And they're like, oh, there's Colin or whatever.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, oh, don't bring him over. Why? We're just having a pint. Hey, Colin, come on, come join us, mate. He's like, oh, yeah. I don't. So you know they don't really get on.
Yeah.
And then he turns around and the other guy is played by Mark Heap.
Yeah.
And what is he?
He's a cat.
Yeah. A giant cat.
Giant cat. And then sits down, and then it like fast forwards to the end of the night, and they're coming out of a kebab shop, and I can't remember who throws the chips at who, but
I think
someone,
the mouse throws the chips,
mouse throws
the
chips at the cat, and then they get into an incredibly realistic drunken fight outside a kebab shop that we've all seen.
Oh yeah.
Like played so realistically. Julia Davis' character like crying, like
it's really, really real. And also, it's shot kind of hidden camera.
Yeah.
And I, looking at the reactions of the owners of the kebab shop that come out and look and then have a little smile on their face because they're obviously watching two guys in costumes have a fight.
Yeah.
And they don't, but they're not aware of a camera.
No.
Like, I really think that this was shot for real.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks that way.
But that fight looks brutal.
Yeah.
Like, Mark Heap and Kevin Eldon are going at each other, and Simon Pegg just having this very realistic frustration of why can't you two just get along?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You always do this. You had a pint. Hey, get off. No, well, screw the lot of you then. Like, it's just, everyone knows how they feel. But they've gone, okay, why don't we just write a really realistic scene, except one of them's a mouse and one of them's a cat, and you know it's not going to get on well because it's Tom and Jerry.
Yeah.
Again, like, I don't know how that's none of this sketch show is that funny on the page.
Mm. No.
I don't really think it is. I think the only sketch that maybe is funny on the page is the sketch where Amelia Bullmore doesn't understand size and scale.
Yeah.
So that opens with her being a company that is a train company are pitching for a contract to her. So maybe a government contract or whatever. She's in charge of a foundation. And he's saying, great, so with what we're doing, and he's got a map on the table of England.
And a toy train.
And a toy train. And he's saying, so with this, we should be able to get from London to Glasgow in, you know, blink of an eye. And she goes, oh, that's amazing. Get there. That was really quick. And he goes, yeah. So, well, that was like 1.5 seconds.
Yeah.
He's like, obviously, you know, it'll be longer than that. In real life, it'd be like 3.5 hours. And over time, you realise that she doesn't understand anything about space or scale or size. And at one point she's like, well, yeah, we're going to have to get a big giant, though, with a giant hand if the train's going to be bigger to push the train along. And he's like, the train's not powered by hands. But again, it's just played very realistically.
Yeah.
But again, that's not quite what the sketch is about.
No.
You think it's that she doesn't understand size and scale with this specific thing.
Yeah.
But then you realise at the end.
Yeah, because she gives a giant check to a little person.
Yeah.
And then faints. Because she can't understand size and scale of anything.
Yeah, of anything at all.
Yeah.
And this is completely just screwed her brain up.
Yeah.
Giving a giant sketch.
Yeah.
Check to a little person.
Yeah.
Oh, so again, it just slightly moves where you think the joke is.
Yeah. Another couple of ones that I love. The one with the one where it's like an office party and they've got a caricaturist and he does a caricature of the boss, and the boss is really reluctant. The boss is like, no, and he's like, go on, it'll be fun. And then he does it, and it's like, it's just a normal, like, it's a caricature, so obviously your features are exaggerated, but he's put a speech bubble and it just says like fat twat or something, and the boss just starts crying, but really realistically, like, heartbreaking, like crying, and everyone's just like, gets really quiet, and it's just awkward, and no one can really speak, and it's just for ages just the boss just sobbing.
Just...
and I'm just like, I don't.
Why have you got this guy here?
Ridiculous. And the other one I wanted to mention was the Too Many Cooks.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Which is a great sketch.
That's with Rebecca Front, isn't it?
Yeah, so that must be season two. Which is... which is basically that they're saying Rebecca Front's running this company that's obviously a kind of catering company, and she's got a spank, she's got like an A board and diagrams, and it gets, and she's like, so you see, we've realized that the abundance of chefs surrounding the vat of soup is actually detrimental to the flavor. And Simon Pegg's like, oh, you could say too many cooks spoil the broth. And she just looks at him. It's like, get out. and then it comes back later. And he's, again, same baker as well. Goes, and so you see the temperature of these iced buns. It seems that the warmer they are, the faster they sell. And then she goes, could say I sounded like hotcakes. And then there's a third one that I can't remember, but there's a third similar idiom gag. And then he just goes, could say, and then she's just back front, just looks at him and just shakes her head. She could say, you just
bugging it
just,
up.
She's got to bugging it up. Yeah. So good.
Again, for what reason in this parallel universe, puns are not allowed by the state, it feels like.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everyone else in the room as well is like,
don't
you're going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very, very, very silly indeed. Very, very silly. But I think that's also what I love about it.
Yeah.
It's really nice to have a sketch show that isn't trying to be anything other than funny. And genuinely is, and delivers on that promise.
Yeah.
How often do you get that?
Yeah.
And also, it stands up really well because it's not rooted in any hate speech.
No.
Which is great for sketch comedy, especially from that time. You know, there are lots of things where you go, oh, people came out of the backlash against political correctness and ended up actually just being awful.
Yeah.
And then also, I think it's doubly interesting when we look at the fact that, as James has mentioned and we've nodded to, the fact that one of these writers actually has turned out to be have sort of extreme, very extreme and hurtful views. It stands up really, really well.
Yeah.
Stands up really well. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed revisiting that.
Absolutely.
And I think it's fantastic. a great suggestion, and it's so nice not to be let down, although so many people do tune in to hear us be let down by things that we loved when we were younger.
But this is another just lovely positive one.
Really positive.
So get in touch, guys, if you have any favorite Big Train sketches, or if you've not watched it yet and give it a go for the first time, let us know what you think of it. Most importantly, let us know how many of you out there are gagging for a Hustle episode podcast, because you know, if we get at least, let's say, like one person that wants it, then we'll absolutely do it.
We'll be obliged, I suppose, then, won't we? I'm tempted, but I think I'm just gonna.
You're worried about what it'll do to me, weren't you? Because you're worried that it's not gonna hold up, and I'm not gonna know what to do.
If that happens, then who's gonna have to clean up the mess, David?
Yeah, no, right? That's a very good point.
They'll all be able to turn off.
That's a very good point.
I'll be holding you. You'll be crying, shaking.
This is true.
The other thing is, what if I really get into it?
Yeah.
And now I can't take this happy for anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I don't want that to happen.
No, we don't want that to happen.
One thing I will say about Hustle.
You might. Got it right.
I've been practicing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know what happens when I get it wrong.
Yeah.
She beat me. I love the theme tune of Hustle.
Oh, great theme tune.
And I love Con Men.
Yeah.
And I remember the real Hustle. I watched quite a lot of, and that was rubbish actually.
Yeah.
But it used to look at how con tricks work and kind of show you how they're done so you could watch out for them. But it was all done in the style of the show Hustle.
Yeah.
Some great cast members, some fantastic storylines.
Exactly. So guys, let us know if you want it.
Some very dodgy writing in places,
but if you want it, we'll do it. Or if you want
something else
or to let us know about anything, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Macabre Podcaster, on Facebook, fb.me/podcastermacabre. You can drop us an email, podcastermacabre@gmail.com. And you can, of course, like, share, subscribe, and listen to this podcast, the Jonathan Creek podcast, all our previous ones, on Google Play, Spotify, iTunes, Anchor, wherever you get your podcasts from. And, of course, the Patreon link is, as always, in the description below. So if you have £5 a month that you want to spend on us doing a podcast on anything, we are still open for business. And let us know.
Thank you very, very much indeed. What a great request.
Absolutely.
From James.
You've paid. He's real.
That's the thing. You've created a fake email account and Patreon account, and you've paid yourself a fiver.
Paid myself a fiver to do Big Train. Yeah. You got me. You rumbled me.
Rumbled.
In the meantime, we will see you again on Monday.
We will indeed.
Yeah. So, I have been David Shopland.
And I've been Callum Hughes.
And we will see you soon.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.